love's my thing, so good it's bad. Love's my thing, so good it's bad.
Good evening. Well, my levels are a little bit too high there, but good evening. You're listening to WEFT Champagne and 90.1 FM. And of course, you can stream us online at weft.org. My name is Ben. This is the program where we are at. We are live here on this very, if you've been outside, it's a very hot day. It is. It may not be technically officially summer, which is usually the summer solstice is usually what, June 21st, but let me bring up what the temperature here is. And it is at what I have right now, it says that it is 94 degrees, and that is going to be is, and now it will dip into the about high upper 80s tonight, but if you have been keeping up with the forecast and looking at, we've already, I believe, got a warning of a of very, very high temperatures. In fact, it is going to get up tomorrow, Tuesday, it'll get up in the triple digits. They say that it will be about 100, let me get the exact forecast. I believe it'll be about 100. They're expecting it to at least be 100. I've seen possibly like 105, 106 degrees. So it's going to be incredibly hot, really all the way through Thursday. It'll be triple digits tomorrow, hitting triple digits, 100. Over 100 degrees tomorrow. Wednesday, it'll be about upper 90s, 99 being the high. Thursday, 95 for most of the day, partly cloudy. And then Friday, it'll be about 90 degrees. And then in this weekend, Saturday, Sunday, it'll be mostly mid 80s. But be careful tomorrow. Drink plenty of water, keep hydrated if you can. And if you don't have to be outside, I would advise that, don't be outside, because it's going to be incredibly, incredibly hot and incredibly just brutal, unforgivable, unforgiving summer. I believe this is record-breaking heat from what I have been reading and understand. I wanted to come in today and do a live show because it is Pride Month. And for those who maybe are a little bit unaware of why Pride Month is in June, just a little history on it. The Stonewall Riots, also called the Stonewall Uprising, began in the early hours of June 28th, 1969, when New York City police raided the Stonewall Inn, which was a gay club located in Greenwich Village in New York City. The raid sparked a riot among bar patrons and neighborhood residents as police roughly hauled employees and patrons out of the bar, leading to 6 days of protest and violent clashes with law enforcement outside the bar on Christopher Street and neighboring streets and in nearby Christopher Park. The Stonewall Riots served as a catalyst for the gay rights movement in the United States and as well as around the world. in the 1960s and the preceding decades were not welcoming times for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender Americans. For instance, solicitation of same-sex relationships or same-sex relations was illegal in New York City. For such reasons, LGBT individuals flocked to gay bars and clubs, places of refuge when they could express themselves openly and socialize without worry. However, the New York State Liquor Authority penalized and shut down establishments that served alcohol to known or suspected LGBT individuals, arguing that the mere gathering of homosexuals was, quote, disorderly. Thanks to activists' efforts, those regulations were overturned in 1966, and LGBT patrons could then be served alcohol, but obviously engaging in gay behavior in public, such as holding hands, kissing, dancing, etc. continued to be banned, essentially. The first documented U.S. gay rights organization, the Society for Human Rights, SHR, was founded in 1924 by Henry Gerber, a German immigrant. Police raids forced them to disband in 1925, but not before they had published several issues of their newsletter. But yeah, there's a lot of history on Pride Month that I would recommend. You know, for instance, in 1966, there was the Mattachine Society, an organization dedicated to gay rights, staged a sit-in where they openly declared their sexuality at taverns, daring staff to turn them away and suing establishments who did. But yeah, there's a lot of history on Pride Month that's very worth checking out and reading about if you haven't read about it. I'm going to play a news program on the ground. This was their recap of this past week. I imagine they covered the whole January 6th commission that started. I believe the first day started about the whole insurrection that happened last year, January 6th, 2021, when, a mob of tried to overturn the election results of the 2020 election. I believe they cover a lot of that and among other many news topics. So let me cue up my audio, make sure everything is ready. I will come around about the halfway mark with some public service announcements and, of course, and talk about the Illinois primary, which I believe is 2 weeks from tomorrow, the 28th. I believe it's June 28th, and early voting is open, so I will talk a little bit about that. Also, along with those other public service announcements around the halfway mark, but I kind of do want to get this program on the ground started. But yes, I will talk about that and among other public service announcements. I'll see if there are any cooling locations in any areas that will for people who are this is what I'm about to play now is the program on the ground. I'll see you. I'll be back around halfway hour mark.
From Washington, D.C., this is On the Ground. What do the attacks of January 6th, the horrific massacre of children in Uvalde, and the U.S. obsession with guns all have in common? The answer is the state of Texas. We spend the hour with our geopolitical analyst, the prolific historian Gerald Horn, discussing his new book, the counter-revolution of 1836, Texas slavery and Jim Crow, and the roots of U.S. fascism.
It grows out of a violent Texas culture that stretches back at least to Texas's secession from Mexico in 1836, not least because Mexico, under a president of African descent, had moved to abolish slavery.
Not only was Texas a bulwark in the effort to maintain slavery, it was a place where the Old South met the Wild West and where the genocide of indigenous people was official policy.
As used to be said in the 19th century, if we're not able to corral Texas, Texas will corral us.
All that and much more coming up. Welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, voices of resistance from the nation's capital. I'm Esther Iverum. 11-year-old Mia Cirillo testified in Congress this week about surviving last month's murder of 19 of her classmates at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas. She said of the 18-year-old gunman, quote, "He shot my friend that was next to me, and I thought he was going to come back to the room, so I grabbed blood and put it all over me," end quote. Before Mia, Dr. Roy Guerrero, a pediatrician who attended Robb Elementary School, rushed to treat shooting victims that day and described corpses of grade schoolers rendered unrecognizable by rounds from a military-style weapon loaded with expanding bullets.
What I did find was something no prayer will ever relieve. Two children whose bodies had been pulverized by bullets fired at them, decapitated, whose flesh had been ripped apart, that the only clue at their identities was a blood-splattered cartoon clothes still clinging to them, clinging for life and finding none.
After this testimony, the House passed, largely along party lines, the Protecting Our Kids Act, which includes 7 gun reform provisions, including banning high-capacity magazines and bump stocks, raising the age for purchasing semi-automatic rifles from 18 to 21, and strengthening federal criminal offenses for gun trafficking. All of the reforms were also passed individually, but are expected to be blocked in the Senate because of the Jim Crow filibuster rule, which would require 10 Republicans for a total of 60 votes to also vote yes for the legislation to pass. The attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, by a mob of supporters of former President Donald Trump was an attempted coup, said Representative Benny Thompson of Mississippi, chairman of the January 6 Commission, during the committee's first public hearing Thursday night.
Donald Trump, the president of the United States, spurred a mob of domestic enemies of the Constitution to march down the Capitol and subvert American democracy. Any legal jargon you hear about seditious conspiracy, obstruction of an official proceeding, conspiracy to defraud the United States, boils down to this. January 6th was the culmination of an attempted coup, a brazen attempt, as one rioter put it shortly after January 6th, to overthrow the government.
Over 2 hours, the committee presented findings from their year-long investigation, including new video of the attack and planning of the attack by documentarian Nick Quested, and video and audio testimony given to the committee from Trump's senior staff and family. The committee outlined what will be unveiled to the public in a series of hearings over the coming weeks. As these dramatic testimonies unfolded on Capitol Hill this week, the Biden administration was in Los Angeles hosting the Summit of the Americas, which is being judged as a foreign policy failure. Heads of state from Mexico, Bolivia, Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador all boycotted because of the Biden administration's exclusion of Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. Journalist Ben Norton said this week on his podcast, Multipolarista, that the boycotting or excluded countries represent more than 200 million people, or one-third of the population of the region, including the Caribbean and Central and South America. Biden's team was doubly accused of hypocrisy at the summit for refusing to invite Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua, which all hold elections, but at the same time planning to meet with the monarchy of Saudi Arabia, which obviously has no elections, beheads human rights activists, and is implicated in the murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. Journalist Abby Martin confronted Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Los Angeles about the murder of Khashoggi and the murder of Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh by Israeli forces.
These are your two greatest allies in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia and Israel. They have murdered American journalists and there have been absolutely no repercussions. And you're sitting up here talking about the freedom of press and democracy. The United States is denying sovereignty to tens of millions of people around the world with draconian sanctions for electing leaders that you do not like. Why is there no accountability for Israel or Saudi Arabia for murdering journalists? It is one of the most dangerous places in the world to be a journalist in Palestine.
In Black Lives Matter news, in Michigan, Kent County Prosecutor Chris Becker announced Thursday afternoon that Grand Rapids Police Officer Christopher Schur will be charged with murder for shooting a Black man, Patrick Leoya, in the back of his head, execution style, following a traffic stop in April. And on Thursday, the U.S. Department of Justice announced the launch of a pattern or practice investigation into the Louisiana State Police over whether the department engages in racially discriminatory policing. Ronald Green, a 49-year-old unarmed Black man, died in May of 2019 after being stunned, wrestled to the ground, punched in the face, and placed in a chokehold by Louisiana state troopers who told Green's family that he died in a car accident. Video of the beating was not released until 2 years after Green's death. Back in D.C., there is also Black Lives Matter news. A celebration was held Saturday, June 4th, to raise money for Asundiata Okoli, who was released from prison after serving nearly 50 years for a murder conviction that his supporters say was politically motivated because Okoli was a member of the Black Liberation Army and a leader in the Black Power movement. Lumumba Bandele, an organizer who worked to free Okoli, told those gathered about the importance of the legal victory.
And we're celebrating something that people said would never happen. We were told that once Sundiata was captured, that May 1973, that he would die in prison. We were told that he would never, never walk out of prison. He would never be able to embrace his family. He would never be able to be welcomed back home into his community. May 25th of this year, we proved them all liars. We did the impossible. Baba Sundiata Okoli is home with his daughter, with his grandchildren right now. And it takes a lot of work. It took a lot of work. And I want to take a minute and ask us all, just take a minute and just do a round of applause for everybody that has worked on this campaign for the past 49 years. Because as soon as those cuffs were put on his wrists, as soon as they were pulled over and shot at on the turnpike, we were working in support of them. We as a movement, I was only 1 year old, but as a movement, we were working. So let's give everybody that's put some work into this a round of applause, y'all. We did the impossible.
Major current actions in D.C. include on June 11th, the National March for Our Lives and the Capitol Pride Parade. And Black Lives Matter D.C. core organizer April Goggins is inviting everyone to virtually attend a June 14th D.C. Court of Appeals hearing to determine whether D.C.'s Metropolitan Police Department must turn over documents to Goggins requested by her under the Freedom of Information Act. Goggins contends that she has been subjected to surveillance, spying, and harassment likened to the tactics of the FBI COINTELPRO program, which particularly targeted leaders in the civil rights and Black Power movements in the 1960s and 70s. Goggins told WPFW's Voices with Vision about her experience.
It doesn't actually matter how involved you are or not. Perception publicly means that you're always a target. So from the beginning, things that we would see during protests, even at Black Joy Sunday, which was like a family event, was just, you know, the police coming around a lot more than they usually did. They were on a call or whatnot. But then it started being them in front of my house, in their cars, or in the alley right across the street with their lights into my bedroom. Or I would go to protests and they would surround me and ask me what's going on. It didn't have to be my protest or anything.
Again, the hearing is scheduled for June 14th, 9:30 a.m. Eastern Time, and can be accessed at the YouTube channel for the D.C. Court of Appeals. More information is at pacapower.org. That's pacapower.org. And of course, people are traveling to Washington, D.C. from around the country for the Saturday, June 18th, National Moral March on Washington, sponsored by the Poor People's Campaign. The march will be covered live across the Pacifica Radio Network. And those are headlines and happenings. This is On the Ground. Stay with us. This is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, voices of resistance from the nation's capital. I'm Esther Averam. Well, 11-year-old Mia Cirillo testified in Congress this week about surviving last month's murder of 19 of her classmates at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas. She said of the gunman, quote, "He shot my friend that was next to me, and I thought he was going to come back to the room, so I grabbed blood and put it all over me," end quote. Before Mia, Dr. Roy Guerrero, a pediatrician who attended Robb Elementary, rushed to treat shooting victims that day and described corpses of grade schoolers rendered irrecognizable by rounds from a military-style weapon loaded with expanding bullets.
Children whose bodies had been pulverized by bullets fired at them, decapitated, whose flesh had been ripped apart, that the only clue at their identities was a blood-splattered cartoon clothes still clinging to them. Clinging for life and finding none.
The fact that Mia and Dr. Guerrero are part of the indigenous population of this hemisphere was not lost on me as I read Gerald Horn's new book, The Counter-Revolution of 1836, Texas Slavery and Jim Crow, and the Roots of U.S. Fascism. In it, he reminds us that in Texas, when it came to the genocide of Native Americans by European settlers, it was, quote, permissible to kill all males 12 years and older by the 1850s, and where the vaunted Texas Rangers were little more than death squads of a type that came to characterize U.S. foreign policy by the mid-20th century, end quote. And with that brief insight, we're excited for Gerald Horn to join us again to discuss more about the latest in his series of books on history, which, of course, always tell us so much about what's happening today. He is the Morris Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. Welcome back to the show, Gerald.
Thank you.
And, you know, I'm thinking in terms of the title of the book that we're going to do this month's episode of the F Word 1 week early, because your book covers what you describe as the roots of U.S. fascism in Texas. So why don't I start with the recent horrific murders of the children in Uvalde and how that relates to your research and what you wrote about in this newest book.
I'm afraid to say that this latest tragedy in Uvalde, Texas, may have been shocking, but it was utterly predictable. Utterly predictable insofar as it grows out of a violent Texas culture that stretches back at least to Texas's secession from Mexico in 1836, not least because Mexico, under a president of African descent, speaking of Vicente Guerrero, had moved to abolish slavery. Those freebooters, so-called Anglos, who had invaded Texas decades before, including Sam Houston and Stephen F. Austin and others who rather arrogantly gave their names to what became major U.S. cities, were not disposed to go along with abolition of slavery. And so like their counterparts and peers on the eastern seaboard of North America in 1776, who seceded from the British Empire because they thought that the British Empire was moving towards abolition of slavery, Texas emulated that maneuver and set up an independent country, the Republic of Texas, which was in existence from 1836 to 1845. During that period, Texas distinguished itself as a major enslaver of Africans. It's no accident that today, Texas has the largest black population than any other state in the Union. It's no accident as well that Texas developed a violent culture based upon the promiscuous deployment of weapons because it faced on its so-called soil a fearsome militant brigade of Native American groupings, probably the most fearsome and militant in all of North America. I'm speaking, of course, of the Comanches in the first instance. I'm speaking of the Caddo, C-A-D-D-O, who had an interlocking directorate with people of African descent. I'm speaking of the Kiowa, K-I-O-W-A, many of whom wound up migrating south of the border into Mexico, where their descendants continue to reside. And so what happens, and this is important for the understanding of the subtitle, The Roots of U.S. Fascism, is that many of the so-called liberals, particularly in Washington, believe it or not, their preferred option, their preferred remedy for Native Americans was to have them migrate into so-called Bantustans, to use the South African apartheid term, reservations. Indeed, as you probably know, there was a massive Bantustan established on the northern border of Texas, so-called Indian Territory, now known as Oklahoma. However, in Texas, that particular option was seen as the option of the wimp. Their preferred option was liquidation of the Native American population. And in that regard, what you need to realize is that liquidation of the Native American population, that is to say genocide, was not just coming from the top down, that is to say from the leaders or from the leaders of the Texas Rangers, which you mentioned. It was also coming from the bottom up because you had a substantial migration into Texas from cutthroats and debtors from Dixie at large, such as Mississippi, from Europe. So in order to understand fascism as it is emerging in North America, you have to understand that it is important, yes, to look at the leaders, such as Agent Orange himself, Donald J. Trump, but we would be misguided and misleading our constituency if we were to assume that there was not a bottom-up element to this emergent fascism. Just as if you look at January 6, 2021, you not only have to look at the CEOs who participated in that so-called insurrection, You have to look at the shopkeepers and the working class elements and the police officers and the soldiers as well. And this bespeaks the nature of settler colonialism. From the time that the English first established an attempted settlement, I should say, in what they called North Carolina in the 1580s, settler colonialism was a product of class collaboration. That is to say, it was not just the 1%, it was the 99%, which brings me to a further point, which is that slogan, the 1% and the 99%, it has a certain usefulness, but to the extent that it elides the point of class collaboration, to the extent that it elides the point that a goodly number of the 99% are collaborating with the 1% because they think they're going to become part of the 1%. And so therefore, we'd be better off perhaps speaking of the one-third, the Trumpistas, the neo-fascists, versus the two-thirds, that is to say, the rest of us. And I think that that's one of the critical lessons that emerges from this book that I've just published on Texas and the roots of U.S. fascism. But what happened in 1845 is that independent Texas could not stand up to abolitionist pressure. Abolitionist pressure in North America, abolitionist pressure from London, and particularly abolitionist pressure from revolutionary Haiti, which was in the vanguard of abolition because it recognized that as long as slavery obtained anywhere in this hemisphere, Haiti's sovereign existence would be jeopardized. And indeed, that fortunately, so far, word that I think has disappeared from our vocabulary, speaking of, quote, being re-enslaved, unquote, that Haiti ran the risk of their populace being re-enslaved. As long as you had these mass enslavers in places like Galveston, because the idea was, why go all the way across the Atlantic to Angola to get black people when a few hundred miles from the shores of the United States, you could get thousands of black people to bring them to the sugar plantations of Southeast Texas.
When you were describing that, I was thinking about our previous discussions we've had around Juneteenth, for example, and this history of people coming from the Eastern Seaboard, coming, I guess, from Georgia, Tennessee, maybe even as far away as Virginia, to go to Texas because it looked like, you know, slavery could be abolished in the run-up to the Civil War, I suppose. And the people would actually just go to Texas because and try to take all their enslaved people with them to Texas where they could continue this process and this, you know, hideous institution of slavery. And that kind of coincides with the, I think one of your early sections of the book is called, I think it's called Where the Old South Meets the Wild West. And this idea of you have all these people coming in with the idea of continuing slavery. You have indigenous people there putting up a fight to not have their land taken over by these settlers. You have enslaved people who know that they could be free if they weren't in this particular situation. And just the violence that was perpetuated just to keep that system in place, just to kind of keep what was a Wild West situation glued together.
Well, keep in mind as well that independent Texas, the Texas Republic, sovereign Texas, saw itself as a competitor to the United States of America. That is to say, it thought that it could compete with the United States of America in terms of denuding Mexico. Indeed, Texas wanted to swallow California before the United States of America swallowed California. And when the United States of America forced the indigenous population of the southeast quadrant of North America, speaking of the Cherokee, the Choctaw, the Seminoles, the Creeks, and other indigenous populations, to embark on the Trail of Tears, walking hundreds of miles from, say, Georgia to Oklahoma, which was then Indian territory, the idea was that you put these disgruntled Native Americans on the northern border of Texas, independent Texas, and that would help to keep Texas in line. Now, part of what I'm saying, alert listeners may have gathered thus far, is a decided rebuke to what I consider to be the liberal fantasies about the creation of the United States of America that focuses upon these vaunted founding fathers, the likes of which we have not seen before or since, who veritably walked on water, who developed this celebrated Bill of Rights, which, by the way, included the Second Amendment, which guaranteed that settlers would have weapons whereby they could defeat the indigenous population and keep the enslaved Africans in line. Certainly, the enslaved Africans had no right to bear arms, because if they did, I guarantee you slavery would have ended before 1865. And those who are familiar with a generally discredited cinematic genre known as the Western knows that one of the stock villains from Westerns is a settler who sells arms to Native Americans.
I'm going to have to pause that right there, as we are actually over half the way mark, but for some public service announcements. But just a reminder that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, station management, the board of directors, or the WEFT associates. And as I said, some public service announcement, here's a great way to support WEFT and get rid of a vehicle that's been taking up space in your garage, driveway, or just in the way. You can donate that car, truck, motorcycle, or boat to Charitable Adult Rides and Services. They pick it up and haul it away at no charge to you. Just be sure you designate WEFT as the nonprofit beneficiary of your gift. Just visit their website at careasy.com. That's careasy, careasy.com. Or you could give them a call. The phone number is 855-500-7433. Again, that phone number, 855-500-7433. And also, if you another thing we would like to announce is, if you could, we would please join us for a jazz celebration of life for Robert F. Selby of FAIA. That will be next week, Tuesday, June 21st, from 5 to 7 p.m. At the Rose Bowl Tavern. The Rose Bowl Tavern patio at 106 North, I believe that's Race Street. Let me just check to make sure. Rose Bowl. Yes, 106 North Race Street in Urbana, Illinois. There will be live jazz featuring music such as Jeff Felgeson and Friends. There will be food and beverages available. We hope to see you there to celebrate celebration of life for Robert F. Selby, who was a supporter of WEFT radio. Let's see. I don't know. I wanted to just read some weather safety. As I said, it's going to get really, really hot. The temperatures are going to be really, really high, up to the hundreds tomorrow, according to the City of Champaign website. They advise you to stay in air conditioning spaces if possible. There's also the library, the mall, the movie theaters. I believe there are cooling centers. I'm trying to see where I can find those. There are cooling centers in Champaign-Urbana. 201 West Kenyon Road. In Champaign. Yes, 201 West Kenyon Road in Champaign. Hopefully they'll be open and available and available to assist and help out. I did bring up about the Illinois primary, which will be, from what I understand, June 28th. So that's two weeks from tomorrow, Tuesday. Early voting has already opened. I know one place where you can, if you want to know about the candidates that will be on the ballot, there's one great place that you can go to that I personally would recommend if you would like, is the League of Women Voters of Champaign County. You can go to their website, LWVChampaignCounty, the League of Women Voters of Champaign County. They're a nonpartisan organization that encourages informed and active participation in government, works to increase understanding of major public policy issues, and influences public policy through education and advocacy. They have information about the election, the races that will be up this year for the 2022 elections. The U.S. Senate nominee for the primary, it'll be the U.S. Senate nominee for the Republican Party. I believe in Illinois, the U.S. House of Representatives seats that are up. Of course, there's the 13th congressional here, and there's the Illinois governor. There's the Illinois Secretary of State, because I believe Jesse White is stepping down or he's retiring. He's been in there for a while. The Illinois Attorney General, the Champaign County Sheriff nominee for the Republican Party. So if you are registered as a Republican, you will be voting for the Republican primary for Champaign County Sheriff. There is also those are the contested race. Now there's also uncontested, from what I understand, uncontested races, so these are some people with no opponent, like Illinois Treasurer, Illinois Comptroller, Champaign County Executive, Champaign County Clerk and Recorder, etc. Now, if you want to see who are the candidates in the primary election, as I said, you can go to the League of Women Voters of Champaign County, LWVChampaignCounty.org. They have a whole bunch of information, who is going to be on the ballot, who's the candidates for federal candidates, Champaign County candidates like sheriff, treasurer, county board, circuit court, circuit judicial court, county board, etc. They have all that information available. It's very, very useful. They do have a sample ballot that you can also look at. It's very, very helpful information. I believe I just also saw that there will be a conversation with elected officials this Wednesday, June 15th at 6:30. I believe it's a webinar, so it's online. You have to, on their website, it's Wednesday, June 15th, 6:30. It's a webinar, conversations with elected officials. City Council member Daniel Inouguez, sorry, I'm probably not pronouncing that right. Daniel Inouguez, Chandra Bishop, and Grace Wilkin. I believe Chandra Bishop is Urbana, is I think Chandra Bishop is Urbana City Council, and as I know I've interviewed Grace Wilkin. I want to say she's Urbana. Apologies. I think she is Urbana City Council. I just want to. Yes, duh. I should know that. I've been following. Yes, Grace Wilkin and Chandra Bishop, both Urbana City Council members. And I believe Daniel Inouyeguez is Champaign City Council. But yes, that will be Conversations with Elected Officials Wednesday, June 15th at 6:30 p.m. You can get that meeting ID and all that stuff information from League of Women Voters, ChampaignCounty.org. Anyways, I think that's all that I have in terms of public service announcements and information useful. I didn't mean to go that long, but just a reminder that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. Now, I'm going to finish this program maybe not finish it because there's still, we only have about 10 minutes left, but I'll wrap come about 2 minutes, three, at the end of the hour, I'll wrap up here. So this is going to continue playing on the air, on the ground.
Helping them to fight back. And so this liberal fantasy, I think, handicaps us when it comes time to confront this emergent fascism, because there's this rampant idea that it can't happen here, as the 44th U.S. president used to assure us at fraught moments, that's not who we are with regard to, say, the shootings at Sandy Hook or the other disgraces that have pockmarked the U.S. landscape. And so therefore, it's a kind of ideological disarmament that these historians have forced on the rest of us, helping to induce a certain kind of lulling, a certain kind of unrealistic view of what can happen on these shores. And this is happening at the same time as the January 6th hearings are telling us that there has been and will probably continue to be continued plotting to forestall the possibility of the right wing ever losing another presidential election. That's why they're gearing up to control the office of Secretary of State in so many different states, because they want to control the office that controls the counting of votes. And so you should see this book on Texas, among other things, as an antidote to the poison of these liberal fantasies, which have misled and misguided generations of U.S. nationals and citizens, and is determined to do so indefinitely in the future unless we turn this ship of state around.
Gerald, hold that thought. We're going to take a brief break and we'll be right back. This is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, voices of resistance from the nation's capital. I'm Esther Ivarum, and I'm speaking with our geopolitical analyst, Professor Gerald Horn, about his new book, The Counter-Revolution of 1836, Texas Slavery and Jim Crow and the Roots of U.S. Fascism. Well, Gerald, also during the recent years, we've had all these important news stories that we've discussed come out of Texas. I'm thinking about the fight for voting rights, how the state has implemented these draconian new voting restrictions, the fight against women's access to reproductive rights, very restrictive abortion laws, and the Texas governor recently signed laws to make it easier for people to get guns and to carry guns out in the open in Texas. And he also said to a journalist recently that he wants to challenge the federal law that requires that all children, including children of the undocumented, must be educated. And I couldn't help think about that when I learned about this horrific massacre of children, largely from the Latinx community. I'm also thinking about how there was this freeze of the power grid structure, and so many people were without power. Some people froze to death. And we found out that Texas alone has its own power grid, which has something to do with its status as being, you know, the Lone Star State and having this kind of the Old South meeting the Wild West again, and just this freewheeling capitalism.
What's remarkable about Texas is that as early as Texas's admission to the United States in 1845, you had liberals, particularly from New England, who thought that this was the beginning of the end of whatever Republican small r experiment was to take place in the United States and North America. And this included, for example, the former U.S. President John Quincy Adams, the son of a president, the second president, John Adams, then a member of the U.S. Congress from Massachusetts. He was amongst those who felt that we either had to corral Texas or Texas would corral us. And apparently what's happening, given the litany that you've just recited, as historians like to say, it's no accident that the catastrophes of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were prosecuted by a president with roots in Texas, speaking of George W. Bush, that the catastrophe of the genocidal war in Southeast Asia in the 1960s was prosecuted by a Texan, President Lyndon Baines Johnson. And folks need to also realize that Texas is the second most populous state in the United States of America, second only to California. Which means that given the fact that the House of Representatives is based on population, probably the vanguard, the plurality of the reactionary members of Congress happen to hail from the Lone Star State. And likewise, if you look at the January 6, 2021, so-called insurrection, one of the points that should leap out is that a disproportionate number of the so-called insurrectionists actually hailed from the state of Texas, even though they had further to travel than, say, people in Virginia, for example. And that gives you an idea of their verve, of their animal spirits, if you like, and of their determination to turn back the clock of time, because that is their history. And as used to be said in the 19th century, if we're not able to corral Texas, Texas will corral us. And you mentioned a moment or two ago how there was this influx into Texas from points due east, not only before the Civil War, but particularly during the Civil War. Because recall that Texas had seceded from Mexico in 1836 on the question of slavery. And then it tried to secede from the United States of America in 1861. And in fact, you could consider it to be the vanguard nation in terms of secession from the United States in 1861. Texas contributed disproportionately to the men in gray who fought to maintain slavery. Texas was the Confederate state least damaged by the U.S. Civil War, which means that 1861 to 1865 and thereafter, as Georgia was seeking to recover economically and South Carolina and other states were seeking to recover economically, the slave owners would flee into Texas. And I'm afraid to say, oftentimes bringing Africans in tow. And this is even after slavery is officially abolished in 1865, which brings me to Juneteenth, the recently proclaimed holiday. Now, what's remarkable, and I say this with no sense of satisfaction, probably the most up-to-date analysis and history of Juneteenth is to be found in these pages. And what I find is that I have reporters who call me even now for comments on Juneteenth, but they want me to tell the traditional story about how General Granger shows up in Galveston, the major slave port, in June 19th, 1865, and tells the enslaved that you're free. Supposedly they didn't know that they were free. But as any high school student should be able to tell you, the Emancipation Proclamation, January 1st, 1863, could not apply to jurisdictions that were not under the rule of the Lincoln government, and that certainly included rebellious Texas. Africans certainly knew about the Emancipation Proclamation, but they were being forced to work for free at gunpoint. So what happens also during this particular period in the 1860s is that France opportunistically had sought to take over Mexico during that period and then work out a deal with the Texas enslavers, whereby either A, slavery could continue and the rebellion of the enslavers could continue post-1865, or B, the enslavers could move with their so-called property into Mexico to continue slavery in Mexico. But what happens is there is a...
I unfortunately have to stop the program there as we're at just at the end of the hour. Just a reminder that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and not necessarily represent those of WFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WFT Associates. But that's going to wrap up here of this program of where we are at here on WFT Champaign 90.1 FM. Also, just don't forget, we can stream us online at weft.org. But I'm going to end it here once again. Happy Pride. I hope you are able to celebrate it. Do be careful out there because it is going to be a hot day tomorrow and probably for the rest of the week. But I hope you can enjoy Pride however you can and be happy and express your love openly and proudly. But where would you play Gimme Shelter from the Rolling Stones album? No Security. But thank you so much for listening and have a good night.
In a sense, we should be.